Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of January 25th, 2016. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How you doing, D.R.?
Doing great. How you doing?
Great. Great to have you, as always, D.R. So D.R., here in the great state of Massachusetts, where we talk about kind of as a model for people outside of Massachusetts, but also as a point of interest for people within Massachusetts. Recently, there's been a percolation upward in discussion about climate issues by the governor, Governor Charlie Baker. He's been in office for a year. In fact, just about now, he is giving his first State of the State address. And one of the things that that he did in preparation, I believe, for the State of the State, or it's clearly coordinated, is that there was a release of a document, which is a five-year update, right? So a report, say, after 5 years, a report on progress against what's called the Global Warming Solutions Act. And so if you're not thoroughly indoctrinated yet, let me remind you, the Global Warming Solutions Act requires, at least in the near term, for Massachusetts to reduce its carbon emissions by 25% by the year 2020. Of course, that's only 4 years from now, so now the rubber is starting to hit the road. DR, a couple weeks ago, you and I talked about how there's a court case trying to decide if that 25% reduction target is actually an aspirational goal or is actually a mandated number that the state must make, right? Those are two very different things. Anyway, the governor gave a five-year, released his administration released a five-year update, and it had a couple comments about Hydro-Quebec and about transportation, DR. So can you tell me what's the state of play with the Hydro-Quebec? What is Hydro-Quebec and why does it matter? Why are we talking about it?
Well, basically, it's hydropower that's going to be imported from Canada, and the Baker administration is basically saying in this report, and they've said prior to and after the release of the report, that essentially the state will not meet its greenhouse gas emissions goals unless we get that hydropower from Canada, sort of ignoring other arguments that, you know, if they focused more on things like offshore wind and expanding solar, they'd be able to meet those goals. But the Baker administration still seems to be pounding away at this idea that we absolutely, positively must have this hydropower, or basically we're going to fall short of our goals.
Right, this is the only one way to get there. So, okay, do you believe them?
I don't, but it just seems to be this sort of absolute fixation. And in his State of the State address, he basically said, and we're going to quote him directly, "If we're serious about reducing our carbon footprint while maintaining a reliable energy grid and improving our competitive position, then we must significantly increase the supply of clean and affordable hydropower. I urge the legislature to move on this now," unquote. So again, he basically seems to be using the bully pulpit to basically say hydropower as the only feasible solution. It's very similar to the people who argue that nuclear power is the only feasible solution or that fracked gas is the only feasible solution. He seems to be just pounding on the drum of hydropower and, you know, screw anybody who basically argues otherwise. It just seems to be an odd fixation on his part.
I guess the number one, we should give the governor credit because he has evolved. When he ran for governor maybe 5 years ago or so, first time, he didn't quite understand what the big problem was with climate change. And now as governor, he seems to be at least recognizing it. And I think we're in a wonderful position of being able to argue about what solution we want to go to, right? So, you know, that's progress, and I give the governor credit. I think, DR, you just hit on perhaps the most important point. is that if we go to Hydro-Quebec for a large amount of our clean energy, especially now that Pilgrim Power Plant is gone, in a sense, we risk this kind of dependence on a single source of single type of energy, right?
Exactly.
I mean, we there's lots of talk about bringing in natural gas, because that carries the same risk of if you put all your chips on natural gas or you put all your chips on hydro, it better work. And I think the argument that I would make is that we need hydro to the Quebec hydro to get through, but it should not be the first option, right? That we ought to be investing in all these other more reasonable local technologies as the first option, and then get back to hydro as the backup.
And there was a great point made in the Boston Globe piece on this that critics of the hydropower plan note that hydropower is not exactly a carbon-free energy source, and that they quote Greg Cunningham of the Conservation Law Foundation stating that, quote, a significant portion of the plan relies on unidentified Canadian hydro resources with unidentified greenhouse gas emissions profiles based on an assumption that the transmission lines will be permitted, constructed, and operational prior to 2020, and all of those assumptions leave the Commonwealth's assertion that it will meet its 2020 goals highly tenuous. So in other words, it's basically, you know, the proverbial bridge in Brooklyn, essentially, that they're basically saying they're basically overpromising and they may be under-delivering.
Well, I think, I mean, the other side of the coin is that, and this gets a little more speculative for me, so I don't want to be creating theories, but it seems like the Hydro-Quebec is an easy one-stop shopping solution that keeps the utilities and the associated industries of Massachusetts quiet, right? Mm-hmm. The utilities do not want solar power because, as we've spoken, it's the death spiral for the utility to have more and more solar. They don't make money out; they don't like it. But Hydro-Quebec, the utilities are happy. Most, you know, sort of the big money constituents of the governor are content with it. I mean, that's not a reason to oppose it, but you look at the governor attending to interests other than the sort of small entrepreneurial startup green companies that we could have.
And to go back to a point we've made before, whenever hydropower is promoted, it's always being promoted with this talking point about how we can't rely on solar and wind because sometimes the wind doesn't blow and sometimes the sun doesn't shine. And this sort of narrative of attacking clean energy sources by sort of exaggerating the alleged non-reliability issue, when in fact it's been demonstrated over and over and over that these sources are quite reliable, and there are plenty of places. I mean, look at Denmark, look at Germany, look at all these countries around the world that are relying upon solar and wind, and they're not freezing and shivering in the cold. Where does this narrative come from in this narrative, and why is it that more is not being done to knock this narrative down?
Well, and it was just a year ago when Governor Baker came into office, and at, you know, 12:01 a.m. on January 1st of last year, the utilities stopped Cape Wind, right? They pulled out of Cape Wind. All of a sudden, with the departure of nuclear power plant and the fact that the Hydro-Quebec cost per kilowatt hour are competitive with what the Cape Wind was going to be, you see, it all of a sudden, the Cape Wind looks like it would have been a pretty darn good deal, right? And anyway...
And interestingly enough, Baker, in his State of the State address, declared, quote, cost-competitive wind options are already available to us, and if advances in offshore wind technology bring a competitive price, then we should embrace them too, unquote. Well, they are indeed already available, but it will take some political will to make sure that they're implemented.
Exactly. Exactly. You can't say, I'll embrace it when it gets good. Call me up when the wind turbine is built. Right? The governor has to lead on this, and that would be a legitimate criticism. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I do think that it comes back to how Massachusetts is a national leader, that even with a governor of the ilk of Governor Baker, who's mm-hmm. not a flaming liberal by any means, at mm-hmm. least he recognizes the issue and seems to be trying to respond somehow. I'd much mm-hmm. rather be debating what kind of green energy we should use as opposed to whether or not we need it, right?
Exactly.
So there's that, DR. Then, so let's jump to something somewhat more international. I heard a report, or maybe other people have seen it. It's slowly creeping into the public consciousness. It's something called the Zika virus. Mm-hmm. I don't even know where it comes from, but it's Zika. Mm-hmm. And the report I heard said that it was rampant in... All of a sudden, it's rampant in Brazil, and they think yes. that somebody flew into Brazil from some other place, I'm not sure where, on an airplane for the World Cup soccer. A mosquito bit that person, and then that mosquito has now given millions of people this Zika virus, and it's a terrible thing because it causes birth defects, right?
There was a great report in Vox about this sort of Zika epidemic by Julia Belluz, who notes that the Zika virus originated in Uganda. That's where it was discovered, in the Zika forest in Uganda in the late 1940s, and up until 2007, there had only been fewer than 20 documented cases. But over the past year or so, it has been exploding, not only in Brazil, but also I think there's some reports that it was found a couple of cases in Hawaii as well as Puerto Rico, and I think there's some concern that it may end up in Florida and Texas as a result of the warmer climate.
Is that forgive me, dear, is that the climate connection? So why does it come up on a show called The Climate Minute? Why are we talking about the Zika virus?
Because the warmer temperatures and a warmer climate basically create a more fertile breeding ground for mosquitoes. And obviously, if these mosquitoes are carrying a disease, that creates a significant problem. There's also a new report that the Zika virus may be connected in Brazil to essentially a weeks-long paralysis from those who are bitten by mosquitoes right. carrying the Zika virus. So it's a significant problem.
I heard the connection. I was listening to On Point Radio, the WBUR show, and the woman was saying that part of the spread of the Zika virus in Brazil is because the northeast part of the country is undergoing a drought, so everyone mm-hmm. is saving water in little cisterns and stuff, which provides mm-hmm. these marvelous standing water reservoirs for the mosquitoes to breed in. And exactly. somehow, so the point is that the Zika virus is just one more of the biblical plagues that are, seem to be visited upon us for the climate issue, right?
And I certainly hope we all remember in the Years Living Dangerously series how the great job Tom Friedman did of covering the connection between the Syrian drought and climate change and the tensions there. I hope in this upcoming season of Years Living Dangerously on National Geographic, they also cover the Zika virus and its connection to climate change, because obviously, you know, if this really starts hitting the United States as hard as it's projected to, you know, maybe that will be, I saw one story basically saying that, you know, could this be what Superstorm Sandy turned out not to be, the thing that forces the conversation and forces people who previously thought it was no big deal to say, oh, this is a BFD, as Joe Biden said.
Well, I think that people will explain away any catastrophe, but if they have trusted advisors, that is to say, if the listeners to this show talk to the people they trust about climate change, that's mm-hmm. the way we're going to get through to people.
Exactly.
Well, we'll follow.
It's one of these things. You know, we discussed. There have been reports about, you know, how this is going to affect the Brazil Olympics, and you know, literally, you know, I hate to be morbid, but what if there is a celebrity, acclaimed athlete who is struck down by the Zika virus in the Brazil Olympics? Will that be a wake up moment for the world to take this seriously? Will that athlete be sort of like the Rock Hudson or the Liberace of the Zika virus? Yeah. That sort of, you know, just as how the deaths of Rock Hudson and Liberace finally forced people who previously didn't care about AIDS to take it seriously. Would that be something that would force people to say, hey, this climate thing is a pretty big deal?
Interesting. Well, so we got to go on to the next story, DR. There's so much to talk about. I noticed we have talked on this show multiple times about Exxon now being investigated for basically falsifying information to its shareholders because Exxon knew in the 1970s that climate change represented a risk to the corporation, but they didn't tell their shareholders, and so there's assorted legal cases in individual states. But what happened this week on the Exxon, Exxon is a bad guy, is a bad company front?
It was reported by the LA Times and Think Progress that California Attorney General Kamala Harris is investigating whether ExxonMobil violated California securities law by deceiving its shareholders about the risks of climate change, basically saying one thing in their own research and putting something else out in the public, and whether or not they basically tried to hornswoggle their own shareholders about the risks of climate change, which means that they would be on the hook for any number of sort of legal liabilities and fines. So it'll be very, very interesting. There is a push. I read that there's actually a push to try to have Oregon and Washington State's attorneys generals also do an investigation, because apparently ExxonMobil did business in Oregon and Washington State. So that means that, that they would be subject to the jurisdiction of the attorney generals in those states. And obviously there is still a push to have U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch launch an investigation as well. So Exxon's problems are not going away anytime soon. The tiger has gone from the tank potentially into a cage now.
See, I was going to try and beat you, DR, and say, make a joke about send lawyers guns and money for as a message from Exxon, but you beat me. The tiger came out of the tank and into the cage. Oh, well, okay. I'm still down one, DR. Okay, so there's the Exxon. But the other story is a much more emotionally devastating story that we just have to touch on. And that is the story in Flint. I'm sure that everyone has heard by this time of the... you struggle to find a word to describe it, but the fact that for the last 2 years, the people of Flint, Michigan have been drinking lead-tainted water because of either complete incompetence or intentional stupidity on the part of their governing officials. Right, DR?
Exactly. Just an utter tragedy, and you know, so much praise has to go to MSNBC's Rachel Maddow for covering this and sort of exposing this story, to the various elected officials who are basically calling for accountability on the part of the governor, in some cases of Governor Snyder, in some cases calling for Governor Snyder to resign. We've mentioned that the reports of Cher partnering with I believe Coca-Cola.
Cher, the actress.
To get bottled water to the residents of Flint, and how sad it is that you have to turn to a celebrity to provide the relief that a government that one pays tax dollars to will not, and just the horror of, you know, the combination of cost cutting, decaying infrastructure, and just, you know, in the environmental injustice of the whole scenario, that basically, again, much like what happened in the aftermath of Katrina, what happens when you basically declare that some people don't deserve help, essentially, or that some people don't deserve the basic necessities of life. And when you have this scenario where government does not respond to a crisis, tragedy always results.
Well, I think that's, you know, again, we were joking before about, you know, why are we discussing this on a show called The Climate Minute? But I think that you've just struck the core of it, DR, that this, you know, despite the sort of political incompetence in the you have to think racial overtones to the whole thing, but this very clear example of the environmental justice movement, right? This is a whole community that is subject to what can only be called an environmental disaster. Right? They can't, it's not like the government stole their money or something. It's the government is denying them this basic thing they need to live. Environmental justice is a big topic for climate hawks, because you see climate change will impose, as you say, environmental injustice on many people. And so this is kind of a teachable moment, or somebody say, yeah, okay, this is what happens when the government goes, malfeasance, right? When the government doesn't do the right thing.
And it also ties into the issue of you know, economic injustice as well, because you know, as anyone who's watched Michael Moore's movies knows, Flint, Michigan was basically, 30, 35 years ago, basically subjected to a complete economic abandonment. Basically, GM and other companies basically decided to walk away from Flint after Flint did so much to try to, embrace GM and embrace its values. And you think about how clean energy, if you could get if you could make Flint and other communities like Flint a hub for clean energy jobs, what that would do to economically revitalize Flint and economically revitalize so many other places, to give people economic and political power to where, quite frankly, if a similar situation happened, there would be a quicker response. I mean, this is something that a lot of the presidential candidates have noted, that if this was a more affluent community,
If
something
this
like
was
this would
Grosse
never
Pointe.
ha exactly, and they would have had the economic and political power to make damn sure that the water was clean. So you just think about how clean energy and the economic stimulus from clean energy could provide some degree of economic protection and economic and environmental justice for
Absolutely.
these
Absolutely.
communities. It's
Absolutely.
these things are all connected. They're all interlinked.
Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't have said it better myself, Tiara. And I get the other thing that I you would want to point out from a climate perspective is in the case in Flint, it's polluted water and people drinking this polluted water. But what this thing teaches you is how fundamentally important water is. I mean, you
Oh,
cannot
yes.
live without water. And
Exactly.
climate change is threatening the freshwater supplies of the entire world. I mean, don't kid
Exactly.
yourself. Even in the United States, as sea levels rise and that water, the seawater, can begin to seep into the freshwater aquifers, and
Yes.
you've poisoned the freshwater aquifer. And now,
Yep.
right? I mean, the issues you've got the people in right? You've got people in Pakistan and India drinking glacial meltwater. That's what they drink, right? And every year, it's replaced with monsoons. Yeah, those glaciers melt, and you have India and Pakistan with nuclear weapons and no water, right? I
Exactly,
mean,
exactly.
so water and climate is an incredibly important issue, and you can see just how important by looking at the turmoil in Flint. Oh dear, I mean, it's we will follow, but it's quite a telling moment, isn't it?
And when you talk about the international issues, think about it. We talk about the international conflict stimulated by climate change. How when we see international conflict, international abuses, and if the United States tries to lecture those countries are going to turn around and say, well, look at what you do to your own people in Flint, Michigan.
Please drive to Flint. Tell them, then
It's
we'll
like
talk.
it's like how back in the 1960s, the Soviet Union would basically say, hey, how are you going to tell us about our human rights abuses? You're turning dogs and hoses on people in your southern states. It's something very similar.
Oh, DR, what a world, what a world. Look, we got to leave it there. We will be back to talk about these things in the future. I just want to tell everyone that they can check out the links to what we've discussed at our blog. It's massclimateaction.net/blog, right? It's a subpage of the main massclimateaction.net website. You can find us on Facebook at slash massclimateaction. Please share us. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher or TuneIn Radio. And of course, you can find us on iTunes. So, DR, we'll close the way we always close by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. Thank you very much, DR.
Thanks.
Thanks to everyone for listening. See you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.